Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
Well, what would Dr. King think about the siege of the Capitol? This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." But what would he say about this particular bend? 4 years of President Trump, culminating in a violent insurrection. Emory University professor Audra Gillespie, who has written about the legacy of the civil rights movement in American politics, joins us to reflect on how Dr. King might respond to the current political moment and the pandemic, which have exposed glaring inequities in our society. We're also going to talk with her about Kamala Harris, who will make history this week when she becomes the first woman and woman of color to be sworn in as vice president. And welcome, Audra Gillespie. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is just talking about, well, perhaps Martin Luther King's, and we honor him today on this day, most famous speech, of course, is the I Have a Dream speech. But there's also the speech that I refer to about the long arc of the moral universe bending toward justice. And on January 6th, you have to ask yourself, and I know you have probably asked yourself, I've asked myself, what would Dr. King's response have been to that insurrection, as well as to these inequities that have been revealed by the pandemic?
You know, I think it's important for us to note that we don't know what Dr. King would have said because he didn't live long enough to be able to weigh in on these matters. But assuming that he, you know, sort of kept on the same vein and on the same trajectory that he was in when he was killed in 1968, you know, I would expect that he would have mourned along with many people in the country at what we saw, which was, you know, violent and anti-democratic and white supremacist in his nature. And I think he would have used that as a clarion call to continue the fight, to recognize that the gains that were achieved in the 1960s could be vulnerable, and that they, and what we always have to be vigilant as a society in making sure that we're standing up to racial injustice and that we are standing up to white supremacy. Sad to say, though, I don't know how surprised he would necessarily be, especially if he had lived, you know, the last 52 years like the rest of us have, where he would have seen fits and starts. And so, you know, I think not only of Dr. Martin Luther King today, but I also think of Roger Smith and Philip Klinkner, political scientists, who are actively working today. And in a book that they wrote almost 20 years ago called The Unsteady March, one of the things that we talk about is, you know, if the moral arc of the universe is long, right, we also have to understand that it's somewhat jagged and that it's fits and starts. And so we do go through periods where we'll take, you know, two steps forward and we'll take one step back as well. And so what we've experienced for the last 4 years was in part a backlash and a response to the breakthrough of Barack Obama's presidency. But this doesn't mean that we have to stay kind of going backwards. There's an opportunity to go forward, and we should be prepared for backlashes and setbacks when they come.
Well, as you indicated, we are in a different time realm now that was so much more polarized during Dr. King's, politically polarized day. And we're now living in an internet world and an alternate universe of facts and all kinds of conspiracy theories and so forth. But what I'm interested in finding out from you is The fact that Dr. King stood for civil disobedience against armed rebellion, and one wonders, when you have people who are trying to start a race war and who are coming to the Capitol armed and so forth, what he might have said of that, given his philosophy, which was embedded in the thinking of Gandhi and Thoreau and civil disobedience leadership.
Well, I mean, he would have opposed it. I mean, he would have opposed it on the principle of what they were standing for, which is, you know, overthrow of a democratic election. He would have opposed it on the grounds of white supremacy, but he also would have opposed violence. And so I think he would have come out against that. I also think that, you know, people have tried to create the false equivalency that because some protests that happened in the wake of George Floyd's murder did become violent, did involve vandalism, that all of a sudden defines Black Lives Matter. And therefore, you could actually equate violent disturbances this summer with the violent disturbance at the U.S. Capitol. They are so not comparable to one another. And I think he would be among the first to call that out. Nobody associated with Black Lives Matter has talked about, trying to go and invade the Capitol to try to overturn the results of an election, even elections that they don't like. Nobody in Black Lives Matter, has proposed, taking pipe bombs to, the DNC and the RNC. Nobody, set up a gallows to try to, to try to kill the vice president if he didn't comply with overturning the results of the election. So, yeah, some violent things happened this summer, but they pale in comparison to what we witnessed on January 6th. And we have to acknowledge that. And those who perhaps didn't support the violence at the Capitol, but supported the incendiary language that led to that moment, have to take a moment of reflection and responsibility and take ownership of that, as opposed to trying to blame it on, Antifa, who clearly wasn't the driving force behind the Capitol siege.
We're talking with Dr. Andrea Gillespie. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. What's on your mind this Martin Luther King Day, and what lessons do you draw from the civil rights movement, and how do you apply them to today? You can give us a call now. We invite you to be part of the program. The number to call, toll-free, 866-733-6786. That number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. And Professor Gillespie, I'm interested in your thoughts about, since we're talking about Martin Luther King's philosophy on this day, there was a book that was published a while back called The Sword and the Shield. I don't know if you're familiar with it, by Penny L. Joseph, who is a prominent civil rights scholar and professor at University of Texas. And what he says essentially in the book, it's a kind of dual biography. He says that and this is a book that's been praised by, a number of Black scholars and leading Black activists, Henry Louis Gates and Michael Eric Dyson and so forth. The book essentially says they were much closer together than most people realize. And they actually, it's not to say, many people do say Malcolm X is by any means necessary, and he was somehow in favor of or countenancing the necessity of violence, where King was always about nonviolence. But they were together on the idea of freedom, on the idea of civil rights, on the idea of human rights, and the idea of advancing the condition. And we'll come back and get your thoughts on that, as well as our listeners, when we return. I see we're coming up on a break here, and we'll be back in just about 60 seconds, excuse me, about 10 seconds. We're going to be gone in 10 seconds for 60 seconds. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Dr. Andrea Gillespie, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And what's that in your mind on this Martin Luther King Day, this day set aside to honor the great civil rights leader? What lessons do you draw from the civil rights movement, and how do you apply them today? You can join us, and we invite you to do that toll-free at 866-733-6786, the number for your calls. again, is 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook or at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. And before we went to that break, Professor Gillespie, I was just asking you about the notion that's in a thesis of this book that I alluded to by Peniel Johnson about the sense that there is a connection between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King that has often been denied because of the silo of violence versus nonviolence.
And while that's an important distinction to make, and I think it's an important distinction that when people talk about violence, whether we're talking about Malcolm X or we're talking about the Black Panther Party, or we're talking about Robert Williams, for instance, who was prominent in the North Carolina NAACP, it was more about armed self-defense, more so than anything else. It wasn't about provocation per se, but it was about being defensive. And sort of understanding that violence was being waged on Black communities and on Black bodies. And so what do you do and how do you respond? I think that, the differences in interpretation really reflect sort of differences in how people interpret how one is to behave meekly. And so being meek isn't being a doormat. Being meek isn't sort of, pretending that bad things aren't happening. But there's a way to sort of harness one's power. And so King's interpretation of nonviolent resistance, rooted, in, what he learned from Mahatma Gandhi, was to take the moral high road. And then from just a strategic standpoint, it actually put people into a position to elicit sympathy and to shame them into better behavior. So when you see people sticking dogs and water hoses on children, in the 1960s, merely for them to be able to get public accommodations or to get the right to vote, right? It actually sort of that contrast in brutality versus pacifism sort of shows the righteousness of the cause of the marchers versus the inhumanity and the brutality of those who were seeking to maintain a vicious system of white supremacy.
That's
but ultimately,
well,
the cause for all of it is self-determination. And all of it is the cause for freedom. And so it's just a question of tactically, what's the best way to get there? What's the best way to achieve freedom? So ultimately, they're both talking about freedom.
Yeah.
And so there are more similarities than there are differences, but we like to focus on the tactical differences.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it. They both are talking about freedom. Let me bring a caller on here. Eric joins us. Eric, good morning.
Yeah, I think I'm just a little bit concerned that the original agenda and message, the broader picture that King brought to bear, might be being lost at this point. He's very concerned that the grievances of poor whites were used against the poor blacks to sort of divide the poor, divide working people, and I think that he was concerned about working people in general, right? And what I see now is an emphasis on the progressive movement, focusing on specific, very racial specific issues and kind of throwing the white working class or the working class in general under the bus. Right. So I wonder if we've actually sort of misinterpreted the broader message of King that should, evolve into the future. And we've let, Trump, address the issues that, some of the issues that King intended for the progressive movement to deal with.
Eric, I thank you for that call. And Professor Gillespie, I think it is true that Reverend Martin Luther King was very concerned about alliances with the working class, the poor white working class. And also he was toward the end when he was assassinated in Memphis by James Earl Ray, very concerned also about fighting against what we could call the military-industrial complex and the Vietnam War.
Yes, I don't want to separate out or silo the obvious interconnections between poverty and racism and hypermilitarism, nor do I want to silo the experiences of poor blacks and poor whites. But I want to sort of bring some history back historically in the United States. one of the problems with creating a multiracial movement around class is the problem of racism. So this is why historians will point out the fact that there hasn't been a really strong socialist or communist movement in the United States, because communists underestimated the extent to which racism was actually pretty pervasive, and how much whites, even poor whites, valued their whiteness to the point that they didn't want to be in political or economic alliance with poor blacks. And one of the longstanding critiques of progressivism is that it casts a blind eye to racial differences that will further disadvantage poor blacks relative to poor whites. That was part of the problem why Bernie Sanders in 2016 had trouble gaining traction in African-American communities when he was running for president against Hillary Clinton, because people didn't like his emphasis on class and actually thought that he had racial blind spots. So I'm not sure that I see an overcorrection in the progressive movement in terms of talking about race. There have been decades of silences. I mean, we could look at the history of labor unions in the United States. So, you know, arguably labor unions are progressive, but labor unions were segregated. And so if we think about like our big major unions, like even today, even as we talk about how they've waned, right, these had their origins in not accepting Black people. So there had to be a separate Black labor movement. I'm not sure that, you know, sort of pitting groups against each other, one, is helpful, and I understand the sentiment there, but I also think it's important to not be blind to history and also not be blind towards the people who might be drawn to Donald Trump, who on the surface might look like they may be drawn towards economic policies, but through their actions and behaviors, and sometimes as we can demonstrate empirically, are being drawn because of a strong attachment to whiteness or and or sort of an attachment to forms of racial resentment. And so what you see when people are coming against sort of, you know, Black Lives Matter and sort of activist groups, or sometimes when you see people storming the Capitol, what they are protesting is a loss of status that was in fact artificial, right? So it's a status that's invested in whiteness that shouldn't normatively have ever been the case, but yet people find it really valuable and they're actually willing to commit seditious acts in order to help maintain that hierarchy.
Yeah, and here's a comment from a listener named Pam who says, I miss Dr. King even more in these unsettled times. To be able to hear a voice of reason is needed even more. And I'm going to bring a caller on here. David, join us. You're on the air.
Oh, morning, all. Happy New Year. I'm glad I'm following that previous caller. I'm interested in the same topic, and it was maybe more Medgar Evers as opposed to Dr. King, who was talking about economics and true value of a person, where it used to be the concept of money revolved around the reputation of the person. And if you had a pile of money, it reflected that you were actually, you know, a hard worker or something like that. But if a thief comes along and steals all of that money and it has a great big pile of money, does that mean they have a good reputation? So it used to be that money reflected a reputation, but it no longer does. It simply is a pile of numbers. So what I'm looking at is the value of our nation after a guy like Trump, who has devalued our currency and devalued the reputation of America by, you know, pretending that he's, you know, a pile of gold instead of a person that cares. And so I'm just looking at how can America regain its value again, regain its reputation again, and become a good citizen in the world?
Well, it's a big question, and it's a question that deserves a lot of time to mull over, and I thank you for bringing it up. We're talking, of course, about more related to the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. Have any thoughts about that caller's question that he raises, Professor Gillespie?
So, I mean, as he was thinking, I was thinking about Weber. I was thinking about the Protestant work ethic. And, you know, I think that in our country, I think we've been socialized to associate perceived wealth with success, goodness, and power. And that's not always the case. Right. And that's part of the thing that we're trying to dismantle when we start to talk about privilege. Right. So if some people, you know, have ended up in an economically comfortable or even, you know, very wealthy situation because they've happened to, you know, inherit it, right, then that's something that they've gotten by matter of birth. That's not something that they've gotten by virtue of, you know, their own work necessarily. And we don't begrudge people, you know, who, you know, have been, you know, in those situations. But, you know, I think it does challenge the idea of might is right, or because I have, you know, all of the, you know, cookies or tokens that therefore I must have done something right. And so that somehow justifies my behavior. So I hope that, you know, we can learn to try to disentangle and always disassociate wealth from goodness, and especially like go deeper and actually look at sort of, okay, well, how did people actually acquire their wealth? What did they do? And if they've done everything ethically, then, you know, we can rejoice in their success. But if they haven't, then I think we can also critique them and make decisions about whether or not we want to align with them, whether or not we want to vote for them if they're running for office, whether or not we want to patronize their businesses.
Before we began the segment, I indicated, Professor Gillespie, that I wanted to talk with you about Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, and indeed I do, because I know you've written a great deal about African-American politicians and pointed out that she was really has been less of an outsider than, say, Cory Booker or Barack Obama. She worked her way up as an insider, and that's both a strength for her, as many people see it, and also something she's been criticized for. But the fact that she's, as a multiracial woman, has a different effect in terms of truth to power than somebody like Cory Booker, Barack Obama, or for that matter, Martin Luther King. And I'd like to sort of suss out from you your thoughts along those lines, because I think we're talking about her as a potential major figure in terms of bridge building, aren't we?
Well, I mean, she's taking over as the number two spot in an administration that is tasked with help rebuilding America from a very tense and turbulent 4 years. So just by virtue of her position, she has a responsibility to try to act on that. And we'll have to wait to see how she and President-elect Biden carry out this monumental task, because it seems that, you know, the health of our country and our institutions are at stake if they don't. You know, my work, I typologize, you know, where Black politicians of her generation kind of fall in terms of whether or not they seek to be racially transcendent, what their ties are to the Black political establishment, what their ambitions are. And so she is similar to President Obama, to Senator Booker. I've written books about both of them in that, you know, they all use racially transcendent kind of postures in order to reach out to people. And I think for people like President Obama and Vice President-elect Harris, the fact that they're biracial, I think probably helps them and gives them a particular sensibility to want to lean in that direction. Vice President-elect Harris in particular, you know, would also be incentivized to do that because, you know, she represents a majority minority state, a state that has, you know, a large and very diverse population. And in particular, with respect to, you know, her African-American and her Asian-American heritage, she comes from groups that, you know, are not going to be the numerical majority of California. So she's had to figure out how to be a bridge builder. So in that respect, I do see common threads between her and other types of politicians who tend to be the ones that are most likely to win statewide office and, you know, the ones that have done well in terms of, you know, national office. Those skills that she's learned, the style that she's used, could bring a different and a helpful sensibility to the White House at this very critical time. So not just by virtue of her identity as a Black and an Asian woman, but also her experiences in law enforcement, her experience as an attorney general and as a U.S. senator might actually allow her to be able to bring key stakeholders to the table to discuss issues of importance. So not least of which would be policing. And so while she garnered some criticism in activist circles because of her prosecutorial ties, it's in fact that resume experience that probably might allow her, if she takes it up as her issue portfolio, to be able to help to move the conversation forward about policing reform and ways that the federal government can help intervene to bring about positive change at the state and local level.
It's good hope that you're signaling us here. I want to also read some emails that are coming in. Speaking of hope, here's Thomas, who says, my reaction to the election is still profound joy. I keep finding myself singing Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. I'd love to hear church bells ringing across the land when Trump leaves office. Robert writes, Republicans from the president on down who promote the lie that this past election was stolen dishonor Dr. King and all those who had their heads cracked and died across the South for demanding the right to vote. And here's Ben who writes, Dr. King wrote the following from Birmingham jail, quote, I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that law and order exist for the purpose of establishing justice and that when they fail in this purpose, they become the dangerously structured dams that block the flow of social progress, end of quote. What does it say about our country when law and order is still such a powerful weapon in preserving white supremacy today? And a listener writes, I'm seeing GOP operatives like Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany and Ivanka Trump tweeting out Dr. King quotes. It doesn't feel performative. It feels hypocritical. How do we make people care and live out Dr. King's message the other 364 days of the year? That is a big question, Professor Gillespie. It still weighs on us, I think.
Yeah, I mean, people have used Dr. King as a cipher. So I think people like the Dr. King of the last part of the I Have a Dream speech because it's very hopeful. It's very optimistic. It's also very conciliatory. They forget that the earlier part of the speech, he was calling America to task to not living up to its ideals, the one that it lays forward in its founding documents. And then if we also look at his later writings, they were strident. And also, like, even in the 1960s, when we think of Dr. King in his heyday, public opinion was actually pretty bitterly divided. And he wasn't the most popular figure. He's been lionized in death. So what I would tell everybody, not just the people who might be performing sort of the sort of usual, let's say something nice about Dr. King and claim to have a dream today, and not get into the things that he was saying that were sharply critical of America, is to go read the other stuff. So it might be read the entire I Have a Dream speech as a starting point. Read the letter from a Birmingham jail, which is very pointed at white clergy for sitting around and doing nothing during the civil rights movement. Go read Where Do We Go From Here? Think about sort of not just the king who's on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, but think about the king who, like, you know, lost support, lost financing when he came out against the Vietnam War, and deal with that king and not just the king that we all want, the king that's, you know, kind and friendly, the king that, you know, isn't real if we consider him in all of his complexity.
We've got very little time left, but I want to get Jacqueline on, who actually heard Martin Luther King speak. Jacqueline, go ahead, please.
Hello, my name is Jacqueline Beggs, and I live in Castro Valley. And in 1968, the thrill of my life and a turning point in my life was to go to the Anaheim Convention. It was the Democratic Convention, I think the CDC Convention. And Dr. King was asked to speak. And I had a very, very small group of people that was with me to hear him speak. To my memory, they didn't give him the big venue of the stage where they later called Bobby Kennedy from. This was for to ask if he would represent the Democrats against the Vietnam War. And the message that King gave to me as I sat there almost front center row was that the Vietnam War was a racist war, and that white poor people and black poor people have to get together and speak up. And I've done so ever since.
I'm glad you have the final word here, Jacqueline, and I appreciate your call. And also appreciate very much, Andrew Gillespie, your being with us. Thank you so much for the time you have spent.
Thank you.
And again, Andrew Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And I guess remembering Dr. King, we should remember not only the importance of nonviolence, but the importance of moving forward and helping the arc of history as much as we can. Please stay safe. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.